Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist for Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Preston Washington. I'm your host tonight. I am stationed in Kansas City, Missouri. I'm a professional genealogist and historian. I am the president of the Midwest Afro-American Genealogical Interest Coalition here in Kansas City. We meet the first Saturday of every month at 3700 East Swope Parkway. If you're ever in town, drop by and check us out. Our meetings are open to the public. I'm also the public relations director for the Missouri State Genealogical Association. Tonight, our guest is Mawari Kamu, who is a Marcus Garvey historian. He's coming on board to talk to us about Marcus Garvey and the Universal Negro Improvement Association. Are you there, Mr. Kamu?
Yes, sir. Mr. Washington, how are you doing?
I'm fine tonight. Thank you for joining us. And you joined us last week and on another show and brought up some very interesting comments in reference to Marcus Garvey. And what do you want to start with us tonight in speaking of Mr. Garvey and the Universal Negro Improvement Association?
Yes. Well, I always typically like to start off kind of giving a synopsis of the history of the movement. Whenever I speak about the history, and, you know, I'm the official historian for the UNIA, and that stands for Universal Negro Improvement Association, and African Communities League. You know, it's the ACL part of the name. As official historian, I like to first start by giving a general history of the movement, and then, you know, as questions come in or if you have any particular questions, because there are a lot of misleading information going on around about the history of the movement. You know, there's a lot of untruths that have been kind of used to reduce and marginalize the movement to just a Back to Africa campaign or, you know, something of that nature. But it was a far broader and more comprehensive plan to help black people, not only in America but abroad, to gain greater control of their destiny, become more self-governing, self-sufficient, industrial, commercial, you know, entity of people that could, you know, produce all the institutions and services and goods that they need for themselves and not rely and become dependent upon other communities to provide those needed institutions, whether they be hospitals, schools, you know, self-defense, you know, Army, Navy. You know, Mr. Garvey was known at one point for saying when he traveled the world and got to see that everywhere he went, people of African descent were not being treated fairly, whether it was in Jamaica, whether it was in Central America, whether it was in Europe. We always were relegated, you know, the worst positions in every aspect of life, whether it's in the world of work or whether it's in our civil rights treatment or any other capacity. So, you know, he asked, you know, where are our men of big affairs? Where is our Army? Where is our Navy? Where is our institutions that, you know, can protect us when we are being threatened and harmed? And since he didn't see those institutions on a global scale lending support to people of African descent all over the globe, he decided to erect those. But I'd like to start anyway by just giving a little brief synopsis, I guess, of the founder of the association and the history of how the movement, you know, began to emerge and rise, and then I'll just kind of leave it there, you know, if you have any questions to follow up from there. Because I know we also spoke about the Niagara movement, because that was a subject of a conversation in a number of the photos on the Just the Freedom, and it had an important role also in it predated the UNIA, but yet some of its most powerful and prominent you know, members or leading, you know, members of that movement actually later matriculated toward the UNIA, and others went to the National Equal Rights League, and others went to the NAACP, and it's sometimes a misnomer.
Who were some of those individuals from the Niagara Movement that had influence in starting the...
Well, the two most notable who were amongst the most prominent figures of the Niagara Movement. In fact, one I know was a member of the Niagara Five. You know, actually, in the photo, you'll see links about 10, you know, individuals standing up by the water fountain. You can see in that photo one gentleman who was probably one of the greatest unsung scholars, intellectuals, activists of that generation was a gentleman by the name of William Henry Harrison Hart. And he shared in the same name as a former state's attorney for the U.S. Some years prior. But he was a black man from Alabama who, you know, walked from Alabama to Washington, D.C. to attend Howard University. And once he arrived, you know, he later studied under some of the greatest legal minds in Washington, eventually becoming, you know, a prominent landowner, setting up a prominent school, and became the dean of Howard University Law for a number of years. Where he later actually headed up a local division, subdivision of the UNIA in Washington, and was one of the legal aides of Marcus Garvey, doing some court cases as well as being a contributor frequently to the Negro World, a number of articles he submitted. But he was, you know, a strong advocate during Garvey's legal ordeals, as well as James Robert Lincoln Diggs, who was a prominent minister, reverend, one of the first, I think, Harvard graduates. But he also later became the acting chaplain general. In fact, I think he was even chaplain general at one point for a few months of the UNIA.
What is the Negro World you just mentioned?
Negro World, I'm sorry, that was the official organ or newspaper of the Universal Negro Improvement Association founded by Marcus Garvey. It ran approximately from 1918 to 1933, and it was written in four languages and spread around the world. At one point, it was the largest black newspaper in the world in circulation, you know. So it's, you know, but that's only natural because the Garvey movement itself was the largest to this date, the largest black movement in the history of the world, having a membership at its peak of 12 million members globally. So it, you know, no surprise that the readership of the Negro World certainly reflected that mass number of people. And, you know, it's interesting, if you look at other people who you would compare movements to, many people thought Dr. King had a pretty sizable movement under, you know, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, but nowhere near.
What were some of the articles one might read in the Negro World?
Well, there were a number of articles. You know, Mr. Garvey had established the Universal Negro Improvement Association to help us become more independent and sovereign in our activities. And to, you know, he always felt that people of African descent are the equal to any other race or ethnic community. So when he would put out the Negro World, it was partly to market products that made by people of African descent. In UNIA membership, and, you know, people who wanted to market their goods and services could use that vehicle. At the same time, it was a propaganda tool to educate us, you know, about ourselves. And the fact it's probably the number one contributing vehicle to the rise of the Harlem Renaissance, because some of the earlier writers for the Negro World who would submit poetry articles about economic development, you know, would sell shares in the Black Star Corporation, which was a shipping line. Distributing goods back and forth between Africa, the Caribbean, and the United States, et cetera. But the Negro World used to put, you know, Zora Neale Hurston used to write articles early for the Negro World. Eric Walren used to write for the Negro World. The early, you know, people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, slow down here just a bit. I got a question about the UNI card that you mentioned.
UNI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how did one obtain that card, and did it include a free subscription, and where was the paper published?
Oh, the paper was published out of New York, and membership in the UNIA would entitle you to some membership benefits. A subscription to the paper wasn't included in the membership fee. The membership fee at that time, I believe, was 50 cents for a membership. So it was, you know, at no time was economics meant to be the deterrent for membership in the association. Anybody on the street should have been able at that time to afford enough to join and become a part and become more active and maybe even make money off of selling the paper, the way you see many people like the Nation of Islam and others do today in the community. So it was, you know, it was a business tool as well, but it was certainly a propaganda tool in the Negro world in distributing, you know, news of what the UNIA was doing, where Garvey would be speaking, where other prominent leaders would be speaking, and how to participate in different news, you know, different black colleges and Negro League, you know, baseball games were announced, you know, all sorts of activities by and about people of African descent were distributed all around the world for, you know, people to see, which, you know, again, added to the rise of consciousness that some people, they label as the Harlem Renaissance, but actually it was kind of a global renaissance, and it was, you know, spurred largely by the father of black pride, the Honorable Marcus Garvey, who was kind of connecting people long before the internet in ways that we've never seen since. You know, this was a person who could organize millions and millions of people and mobilize. You know, you talk about in 1920, he held a convention in New York City. The convention had a parade that was a 10-mile route. In that 10-mile parade.
Before we get to that, I want to remind our listeners that they can see a picture of the Negro world on Leslie Gist's Facebook page and also the Gist of Freedom at www.blackhistoryblog.com. Now, speaking of Marcus, why don't you take us back to Marcus's origins. When and where was he born, and a little something about his early life before he got to New York City.
Okay, Marcus Garvey was born 2 years after the Berlin Conference in 1887, on August 17th in St. Anne's Bay, Jamaica. His father and is argued to be of Maroon heritage. He was, you know, supporter of a number of nationalist movements in Jamaica at the time, and pretty well read. He had one of the biggest libraries in the neighborhood. You know, for people of African descent to have that kind of library was kind of impressive in that time. And his mother, you know, who was
Can you tell us what is what do you mean by Maroon for some of our younger listeners out there?
You said what I mean by what?
Maroon.
Oh, Maroon. The Maroons were a group of people who not only resisted their enslavement as they came over from Africa, but actually who broke free, went up normally into the mountains or into, you know, the interior of the island, the jungle, and they would establish, you know, a colony or a nation state of their own to govern and protect themselves from the invaders who would come and try to re-enslave them. So these were separate independent societies, you know, of free people that broke free from their oppressors. And, you know, a lot of these societies, you know, to this day are still thriving in Jamaica. Mostly Jamaica, if you look at the island of Jamaica, the center of the island is pretty much a huge Maroon, you know, a group of Maroon compounds. And all on the outside of the island is the government, Jamaica's territory, where all the cities are. But, you know, these areas were, you know, lands where, you know, we broke free and regained our independence. So many people, and the importance of saying that was many people who developed that sense of identity or dignity and destiny in that Maroon society, they knew they were of African descent. They knew they weren't slaves. They knew they weren't, you know, destined to be servants or docile, dependent people upon any other group. So they had a lot of, you know, pride and self-respect, and they, you know, never considered themselves to be inferior to anyone. So that attitude was important in the development of young Marcus.
We appreciate the explanation, and we really don't mean to interrupt you, but when we hear terms such as that as Maroon, we can't take it for granted that everyone really understands these terms. So from time to time, I may come in and ask for that kind of explanation. Now, these Maroons, were they Rastafarians? What kind of religion were they involved in, or do we know?
Some of the Maroons later yeah, many of them later did adopt the Rastafarian faith. But you know, the Maroons actually were, you know, just really Africans who, because of their resistance and struggle, defeated the British in Jamaica, established a treaty to, you know, develop an independent nation within the island of Jamaica. And to this day, it's still, you know, they're not under the laws of the Jamaican government, who were some of these, again, outskirts cities that Kingston, Montego Bay, other cities that are part of the government of Jamaica that was a, what do you call it, the Commonwealth under, you know, British rule.
Right.
Yeah.
Were they
tri-racial? You know,
mm-hmm. Were they tri-racial?
No, these were people. Yeah, these were people of African descent who, you know, I mean, I can't be 100% that no one outside of the enslaved African community ever joined them, but these were at least predominantly, if not exclusively, people of African descent who developed these nation states, you know, for their, you know, development and protection, defense, et cetera.
Okay. Now, and was the UNIA first established in Jamaica, and about what year was that?
Yeah, well, the UNIA certainly was established in Jamaica in 1914, and the history behind its establishment came from, you know, young Marcus Garvey. Once he was always a great reader. He was one who advanced, you know, ahead of his class. He was in an oratorical contest, and, you know, 12 years old. By the time he was, you know, a young lad at 14, his uncle, actually his godfather, had taught him printing, and he became, you know, at an early age, a young master printer. And eventually he had headed up a government printing press, and he was more advanced than many people who were 2-3 times his age. And, you know, he was, you know, managing people 3 times his age. Eventually, there was a strike at the press, and, you know, a lot of the workers came and, you know, protested, and Garvey, being part of the management, didn't have to protest, but he decided to throw his lot in with the people and started fighting, you know, for better treatment, you know, and fairness for the workers. And eventually, after the strike was ended, all the workers got their jobs back, but Mr. Garvey didn't. And that kind of forced him to look for work elsewhere, eventually leading him to to the Central America as he traveled, working in different places. He started to notice that, again, you know, we were treated poorly everywhere we went. He noticed that the Asian workers during the Panama Canal development, when they complained, you know, cause a lot of times workers would get paid, and then as soon as they leave the job site, they get robbed on their way back home. But when the Asian community, who was also working there, complained to their embassy, the embassy got redress for these workers. And, you know, the embassy threatened that they would go to war if they mistreated their workers over there. So it was no problem for them. But then when these African people, like Mr. Garvey, people of African descent, went to the British government and said, hey, you know, they're mistreating us, you know, defend us. The British government said, we ain't got nothing for you. You know, we're not interested in defending you. That's your problem. So he started to develop a sense of, you know, who's going to look out for us? We're going to have to look out for ourselves. So eventually, as he came back, he had gotten sick when he was in Central America, malaria. So he came back to Jamaica for a while and eventually went to London, where he went to school for some years. He worked with a prominent Egyptian scholar and bookstore owner, magazine printer by the name of Duse Muhammad Ali. And that introduced him to a number of people who were writing articles in Duse Muhammad Ali's African Times and Orient Review magazine that he was a distributor of. And in that paper, you had people like like John Everett Bruce, who was a prominent newspaper editor and publisher and activist. You had people, like Booker T. Washington and others who would write for the paper and submit articles. And eventually, working in that capacity, traveling, and also still fighting for redress for people of African descent, Mr. Garvey finally read a book that inspired him more than any other book. And that book was Up From Slavery by Booker Taliaferro Washington. And in that publication, he began to develop a sense of destiny, you know, that we could actually, you know, pull ourselves up and develop institutions and vocations, become a nation-building society globally. And he started to develop the idea, which ultimately, when he returned to Jamaica, was founding, you know, the UNIA, which was part educational, but it was also a society to help, you know, people to inspire confidence, to develop industry, commerce, trade, et cetera. So it was the founding of the UNIA started in Jamaica, and shortly thereafter, upon invitation of Booker T, he came to the U.S., and that's where some of the, you know, the history or the miracles that he was able to perform and things he was able to accomplish really took place.
Okay, Mr. Camus, was his wife, Amy Ashford, was she a co-founder there in Jamaica?
Well, his wife, yes, Amy Ashford was, she wasn't his wife at the time. But
and what happened in Jamaica that caused him to come to the United States and establish the UNIA in Harlem?
Well, he was actually active in raising funds in Jamaica for the industrial school he was attempting to develop there, similar in, you know, format to that of Booker T. Washington, the Tuskegee Institute. And after being in communication with Booker T had invited him to come to the U.S. to visit him and, you know, go on tour to raise funds for the UNIA in Jamaica. And upon his preparation to go to the United States to visit Booker T, unfortunately, Booker T had passed away. Of course, he still followed up and visited, you know, the U.S. and went on a tour and spoke to a lot of people about the problems. And, of course, at that same time, he was realizing as he traveled that the same problems people were facing in Jamaica, they were facing in St. Louis, they were facing in Washington, they were facing in New York and every other place in the United States that he traveled. And so he felt that, you know, he would be remiss if he didn't try to at least establish a branch of the UNIA in New York or in, you know, the United States. So after founding a chapter in 1917 of the UNIA in New York, you know, some problems began to emerge. It was right, you know, in the midst of a political election that was up and coming. So a lot of opportunists had joined the division because when they see it started to grow in size and number, and they started trying to use the association for their personal gain, eventually causing Mr. Garvey and some of the early founders of that division to dissolve the corporation and eventually, less than a year later, reform in 1918.
Mr. Camus, did he ever get those schools established?
The Jamaican school never got developed to the extent that he wanted it to. He eventually did produce a number of schools, like Booker T. Washington University in New York, the Liberty University in Virginia, and you know, which was a huge estate. There was actually a school compound that was ran by Nat Turner's grandson, Smallwood.
Is that Liberty University that we know of today in Virginia?
Exactly. Exactly, the same building, Claremont, right. That was formerly, again, you know, administrated as the principal was once Nat Turner's grandson. And eventually after they and those school administrators lost control of the building, couldn't afford to keep paying on it, the UNIA came and purchased it and salvaged it as a historically black institution and taught for a number of years a racial education and, you know, prepared the young students to accomplished great things, you know, from that vantage point, even though that didn't last nearly as long as we had liked. But that's another story. But, yeah, he did eventually develop some institutions, but the nature of the movement and the drive to develop industry started to grow. You know, during this time, of course, is World War One that's taking place. And at that time, Mr. Garvey noticed that a lot of people were buying war bonds. They were putting, you know, a lot of blacks were putting a lot of money in stock in the U.S. government, you know, giving it enough funds to conduct the business it had to conduct and making, you know, it wealthy and successful. And he felt that the same way that we were putting our resources in the United States government to make it strong, that we could devote them to ourselves and develop an internal nation state of our own, that we can, you know, the concept of the African Communities League was to have a group of independent African communities of African descent throughout the U.S. and abroad that would connect into a federation or into a, variably, an empire that would be a self-governing body that would, you know, be able to, you know, have commerce, trade, to be able to politically support one another, et cetera. But it was a set of institutions and communities that were coming together, people of African descent, so that we wouldn't be, again, you know, doing this segregation south and north in a position where we couldn't have the institutions we needed for our well-being, whether it be, again, hospitals, schools, or any other institutions that we were dependent upon others to provide for us. You know, we circumvented their need because we had provisions, you know, amongst ourselves, and we were developing a number of auxiliaries and institutions like the Black Cross Nurses, which was our version of the Red Cross. Because Red Cross wasn't, as you can see in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where there were a number of Garveyites, the Red Cross did not respond favorably to us as they did to people of European descent who were injured, and they addressed their needs before they would even cater to us, if they even eventually catered to us at all. So we felt the need for us to establish institutions like the Black Cross of our own, as well as, you know, the industrial institutions and the commercial ones like the Black Star Line. This was one of the crowning glories of the UNIA. You know, Garvey was able to organize resources amongst people of African descent to put together a Black Star shipping line, which, you know, was distributing goods and services.
How was Malcolm X connected to the Garvey movement?
Well, Malcolm X was connected in several ways to the Garvey movement. His, you know, father was an organizer, and his mother was a secretary of the UNIA division, I believe, first in Milwaukee, and then also in Lansing, you know, in Michigan. You know, they actually met first at a UNIA meeting in Canada where Malcolm's mother actually was related to the commissioner of Canada of the UNIA. Anyway, she met her husband there and later had children, one of them being Malcolm. And his father eventually got killed because of his organizing UNIA. And you can see, you know, that his mother, according to the autobiography of Malcolm, at a young age, all the children were required to read from a Negro World every week. They were required to give a report on what they read. And, you know, this was a constant instilling of certain principles and doctrine and dogma of the association into the children, so much so that when Malcolm was young, lad in junior high, and they asked him to sing the national anthem, he told him he had his own anthem, you know, a black anthem, which was a universal Ethiopian anthem, which was the official song of the UNIA and of the race at that time, which, you know, is something to speak to the impact that the Garvey philosophy and program had on Malcolm's life, you know, so much so later that the person who wound up being the leader of the Nation of Islam, who he followed, was himself a rank-and-file officer of the UNIA out of Michigan. Elijah Muhammad formerly was Elijah Poole and a corporal in Marcus Garvey's UNIA defense wing, which is called the Universal African Legion. So, you know, everywhere he went, you know, there were Garveyites that he identified with and connected with as he spoke and organized in different places. And
Can we back up a moment to talk about the nurses, the black nurses? And you mentioned that they were formed in response. Was that to the riot that was in Tulsa? I believe that was 1919. And what about the race riot of 1917 in East St. Louis? Was that where Marcus might have got the idea for the black nurses?
Well, the idea actually came in 1920 in Philadelphia. I mean, it was actually formed or founded in Philadelphia in 1920 by one of the women who were a leader in the UNIA by the name of Henrietta Benton Davis. She was actually an elder to Garvey, you know, by 27 years, but she was also accomplished in many ways. She was the cousin of Frederick Douglass. She was accomplished Shakespearean actor who traveled the globe and was well known and respected, you know, for her craft, and she later joined the Garvey movement as an assistant president and international organizer. And one of her auxiliaries that she founded was the Black Cross Nurses. But it was formed in 1920, right before the Great International Convention and plebiscite that was held in August of 1920. But it was certainly a response to, because you'll notice, as we mentioned, that many of the soldiers were coming back from the war. the riots were actually caused by the return of many of the white soldiers who came back and found black folks were working the same factories they used to work, and they wanted their jobs back and sometimes got pretty hostile about how fast they wanted their jobs back, and it caused a lot of hostility. Yet at the same time, you had black soldiers who were coming back from the war who just went to France and Argonne and tore up half of that country, and you know, were respected not by so much the United States government as they were by the French government. The French government is the one who gave them uniforms. The U.S. government wouldn't even give them uniforms. So when some of these soldiers came back, you know, the Harlem Hellfighters, et cetera, marched in parade in Harlem, et cetera, Mr. Garvey saw that and saw how significant and how important that was to the people to have not only that type of parade and pageantry, you know, but to have a defense wing during these times where the lynching was, you know, getting far out of control, where the, you know, assaults, you know, blacks in different parts of the country was, you know, really.
Let me interrupt right here, Mr. Camus, and remind our listeners that they're listening to the Gifts of Freedom. And if they should want to call in with a comment or a question, they can do that at 347-324-5552. Now, you mentioned a little earlier there Ethiopia. Are you aware of any history of Ethiopia and any relationship with Garvey?
Oh, yeah, it was a whole lot of history. You know, Ethiopia, there's two Ethiopias. There's one, which is the current nation state that we regard as Ethiopia, and then there's the term Ethiopia that many within the Garvey movement, and at that time, you know, Ethiopia and Liberia were the only two nations that had even flag independence in Africa. So when people refer to Ethiopia as the only unconquered land in Africa that is, you know, truly Africa, they sometimes will refer to the entire continent as Ethiopia. So, you know, when that term is used, like, you know, at 1920 convention, which is an important component of the Garvey movement, you have to really understand that because in many ways that was kind of a climax. But it was an important gathering of convention because at that 1920 convention, there was a Declaration of Rights of Negro Peoples of the World that was delivered. This was a convention where, like I was starting to mention earlier, they had parades that were 10 miles long, which is phenomenal even by today's standards, to have a parade of that magnitude. You had 25,000 delegates who attended convention for 30 days in New York, filled Madison Square Garden to capacity, and they had another 15,000 delegates outside trying to get in, you know, as standby. You had, you know, at that time, the shipping line, you had, you know, the auxiliaries, you had all kinds of institutions developing, and the people who came together were some of the greatest thinkers, lawyers, businessmen, you know, heads of, you know, state who assembled. In fact, the mayor of Monrovia became the potentate for the UNIA, but it was a huge gathering. It was the only plebiscite you can really say we've ever had as a race. In New York at that particular time, you know, we came together, and one of the things that was adopted as the official symbol for our race and for our national interest was the red, black, and green flag. Mr. Garvey himself introduced that item. Alongside that, there was an adoption of a song that all these delegates came together and adopted called the Universal Ethiopian Anthem. And that Universal Ethiopian Anthem is a song we still sing today. It was actually the only anthem that was unanimously adopted by us, unlike many of us think now the James Weldon Johnson hymn that we consider an anthem, but wasn't really adopted by us. That was more of an NAACP adopted song at a time when they were still founded and funded by Jewish people. So it was kind of a different thing.
Can we find that anthem online now?
There is. I don't know if it's easy to access to it. There are a few videos that I've actually even produced. The song, the anthem, is being sung at the same time, and I can give that information now. I'm an administrator for the Millions for Marcus Garvey site on Facebook. One of the videos that I put up actually is kind of has a number of the early hymns of the UNIA, one of them being the Universal Ethiopian Anthem. But there's the lyrics for it, I believe, are also written on our website, the UNIA-ACL.org.
Okay.
And that's another way, but, you know, certainly if any listeners contact you to contact me, I can forward that to them. I think I even have it on my page on Facebook, a history of the anthem and, you know, how it came to be.
What was the relationship of Islam to Garvey, and was Garvey a Muslim?
He was one also that, and I, just to go back to Ethiopia a little bit, he did have a long-term favorable relationship also with Haile Selassie, who he was in communication with at least as early as 1922, and who wrote for the convention, wrote the convention in 1922, you know, asking that any of us who wanted to repatriate, you know, we are welcome to come to Ethiopia and help, you know, it build and produce, et cetera. You know, and later when Ethiopia was attacked, you know, Mr. Garvey was one of the fiercest advocates in rallying people to support the people of Ethiopia and, you know, fighting against the Italian invasion. So that, again, is another part of that history. And many of the early Rastafarian elders who formed or helped promote Ethiopianism or the Garvey movement, like Leonard Percival Howe, who set up the first commune in Jamaica for the Rastafarian movement. He actually was also an officer in the UNIA at one time in Brooklyn. And, you know, many of these people are Garveyites, and they looked to Garvey as the inspiration behind the movement, because Mr. Garvey had earlier in Jamaica, when he returned to Jamaica back in the 30s, he had conducted a play called Coronation of an African King. And in this particular play, which took place about a month before Haile Selassie was crowned emperor of Ethiopia, in the play, Mr. Garvey, who a few months earlier had seen the Queen of England visit Jamaica and was disappointed that people of African descent were running around chasing and groveling and trying to touch her gown and just, you know, falling all over the place trying to pay reverence to the Queen of England. But he was telling them that you are from Africa. Your kings and queens are on the motherland. Now look at you. You're not from Europe. You know, these people should be following their queen. But she's not your queen. And that's when he quoted the scripture that princes to come out of Egypt and Ethiopia shall stretch forth her hands unto God, which is a call for us to start looking back to, you know, our homeland as the source of our, you know, royalty and divinity, et cetera. So anyway, after he said that and then Haile Selassie was crowned emperor, many people, you know, took that as him being a prophet to announce the coming of Haile Selassie, so to speak. And that's why he's kind of revered in the Rastafari community as a prophet, et cetera. But going back to Islam, Mr. Garvey was Catholic for the most of his adult life. He grew up Methodist, but he was one who believed in a degree of universal spiritualism. He was one who didn't try to beat people up with his religious belief, but he, if anything, inspired us to have faith in ourselves and to develop a faith and confidence in ourselves as opposed to a commitment to a particular religious strain. But you'll notice some of the early hymns of the UNIA would speak of Islamic terms. You'll see what it might say, the God Bless Our President song starts off with, Father of all creation, Allah omnipotent, supreme over every nation, God bless our president. And then you have another hymn talking about in the Ethiopian anthem, oh Jehovah, the God of the ages, grant unto our sons daily the wisdom thou gave to thy sages when Israel was sore in need. So you're going now to the more Hebrew. At the same time, you know, he considered Jesus the standard bearer. And, you know, as one who sacrifices all and gave him, you know, everything he had, including his life, on behalf of his friends. So you'll see a universal appreciation for all faiths because he had one premise, and this kind of goes into Islam as well as Christianity. His premise was that we were all created by the divine. You wanted to say something?
Now, some of those songs you just mentioned, et cetera, are they on that site that you mentioned, and that site is...
The God Bless Our President is also on the Millions for Marcus Garvey. I'm not sure if that's on the UNIA, you know, ACL.org site. But I can make all that available to those who are interested in learning more.
That site...
But the point I was going to make about Garvey's religious, you know, belief, it was rooted in the fact that he considered of all faiths, of all the major religious systems, Islam, Hebrew, Christianity, there was a certain common thread that he noticed, and this was his interpretation, was that we all were created of one blood, and, you know, we all reign on this, you know, on this earth in our respective areas. You know, Europe was ran by Europeans. You had Asia ran by the Asians. Africa ran by African people. And this is, you know, how things begin to develop. We all were entitled to our own vine and fig tree. We all were given certain gifts and talents and were expected by the Almighty to use those talents for our benefit. So when one group of people were able to, you know, come and dominate and invade in another people's territory and establish dominion there, it was largely as a result of the people not using their talents to defend themselves and protect themselves and to develop. So part of what we needed to do to kind of restore our sense of dignity again was to reclaim what was taken, which was our, you know, sovereignty, our independence, our ability to form nation states, our ability to govern our own affairs, and largely, you know, our African homeland, which was invaded and dominated, you know, economically, politically, and otherwise by alien races, you know, to the motherland of Africa. So part of an important program in the UNIA was the African Redemption Program, but it wasn't the sole, nor I would say central, but it was a serious project or component within the program of the UNIA to reclaim our motherland.
Mm-hmm. Can I interrupt here a moment? I'm getting some emails. People are really wanting that site again, and it's UNIA-ACL.org.
That's right.
Okay. Now,
and millions for Martha Garvey on Facebook. You know, they're welcome to, if they're on Facebook, to visit.
Okay.
And in there, I have a lot of pictures and information, and the Marcus Garvey Culture Club has a lot of photographs also of the movement. But, yeah, you can continue.
Can we talk about his vessel? Now, he started a company called the Black Star Line.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah, he started the Black Star Shipping Line in 1919. This was one of the most profound undertakings ever at that time. No one thought it was possible. Black folks came out and supported in mass. I mean, and this is when you get to really feel the sense of pride of the Garvey movement, because up to that point, you know, people always say, what would happen if black folks come together? You know, we come together as a people. The Garvey movement was a reflection of a time when we came together, when we did a whole lot more with less. And to see everybody, you know, who had any kind of resources, putting them on a project that wound up paying off, and us having a fleet of ships to travel, you know, a lot of people were from abroad who bought shares in the Black Star Line. They were, you know, from Caribbean, from Africa, et cetera. And they wanted to see, not only did they want to revisit their homeland, you know, in fact, my great-grandfather, who died in 1923, he was alive during that time. He actually came to the United States in 1850. He was kidnapped and brought here from Guinea at a time when slavery was supposed to have ended. But a lot of these people who were supportive of the Black Star Shipping Line project wanted to go literally back home to where they had been forcibly taken against their will, as well as those who had came over here and et cetera, didn't, you know, achieve all the success and who just wanted to go back and visit, as well as goods and services were being exchanged, you know, from our homeland through the Caribbean, you know, to the north. And we were trying to utilize some of the greatest minds to help technologically develop Africa. And, you know, just like today, Africa still needs an industrial revolution. It still needs a technological revolution. The very people who introduced the advanced sciences and cultures to the world now are the most, you know, derelict. You know, we the ones who need others to teach us some basic technology now in order to, you know, produce raw materials that we have in our own homeland. Everybody always say we're poor, but the problem is not that we're poor. We got all the wealth, the coltan, the gold, diamond, bauxite. It's just that we're poorly organized. You know, we're not outnumbered in the world. We're just out-organized. So Garvey's legacy, you know, again, is always in how to organize us to form institutions for our best interests and collectively, you know, support one another. So you'll see that in the Black Star Line, as well as one of the institutions he actually built shortly after the Black Star Line was the Negro Factories Corporation. And the Negro Factories Corporation was you know, producing a number of black dolls. They were producing, it was a millinery, you know, they were producing hats. They had grocery store chains. They had all kinds of
industries, and some of these products were being sent to different divisions and, you know, the different patrons and customers throughout the globe through the Black Star Line and through the African Motor Corps, which was another institution. You know, he had a fleet of vans and trucks sending goods and services throughout the U.S. and abroad. So, I mean, these types of industry and institutions were very well regulated and planned and strategically implemented.
Let me interfere for a moment. You mentioned that Booker T. Washington was an ally of his. What about Phyllis Wheatley? Was she an ally? And what were some of the other allies of his in the Black movement, in addition to any opponents that he might have had?
Yeah, well, he certainly had a lot of support. And another misnomer is that Mr. Garvey's movement was mainly a movement amongst poor, uneducated people. This was a huge fallacy. Many of his organizers were some of the greatest lawyers, greatest ministers, greatest scholars that we've ever produced. Many, in fact, of the American Negro Academy were members of the Garvey movement, like, you know, William H.H. Hart, like John Everett Bruce, like Arnold Hamilton Maloney, and a lot of other prominent, you know, super intellectual scholars, George Alexander McGuire. I mean, some of these people had double doctorate degrees, masters, et cetera. Washington alone.
What was his relationship with A. Philip Randolph?
Early on, there was sympathy to Mr. Garvey's program by A. Philip Randolph. You know, Garvey, being, as I mentioned before, was active with the unions, you know, as A. Philip Randolph was. He came, you know, to the United States primarily to promote the program in Jamaica. But as time went on, he began to see that he needed to broaden the scope of the association instead of branch in the U.S. And at that time, he started to have success in growing numbers in the U.S. A lot of his membership came from the ranks of, you know, the A. Philip Randolph movement. You know, in fact, I think Domingo was once a writer with The Messenger. Who later became an editor for the Garvey's, you know, Negro World. A lot of people who were with different, you know, socialist movements, with certain religious movements, they all, you know, not all, but many of them, Hubert Harris and others, you know, came toward the Garvey movement and joined ranks with it. So many people who saw their memberships decline while they seen Mr. Garvey's UNIA expand. They began to develop a little animosity, and they started to criticize him. And in fact, John Everett Bruce, who later became the greatest.
I want to interrupt right here. Tell our listeners who A. Philip Randolph was.
Well, he was a union organizer. He was Chandler Owen. They had set up a newspaper called The Messenger. It was, you know, socialistic. It was, you know, pretty popular. Workers. He founded the Sleeping Car Porters Union, you know, which had quite a huge following years later. And even during that time, they had a lot of popularity. But he was kind of a well-known, respected union organizer. And there's some other things I can probably say about him that I'll just leave to another discussion concerning his orientation. But there was, you know, he was a prominent person and player in the game. In fact, he was one of the first ones to invite Garvey to Harlem to speak in New York. So he was early on a great supporter, but later, as they kind of had a fallout ideologically, he became one of his greatest opponents and eventually formed a group called Friends of Negro Freedom, whose primary objective was to destroy the Garvey movement. Eventually, even though W.E.B. Du Bois was once favorable of Mr. Garvey's business acumen and his ideas and et cetera, eventually even he was kind of pressured. And the reason most of these people were pressured again is because at that particular time, and many don't want to talk about it, the NAACP, which was founded by Major Joel Espingarn and a number of other Jewish people at that time, this was a European-founded and funded entity, and they attracted a few blacks from the Niagara Movement, from National Council of Negro Women, you know, other entities that were around at that time. But this was a movement that was ran not only by a Jewish elite, But Joel E. Spingarn was also doubled as the military intelligence officer for the Negro Subversion Division in the U.S. military. His job was to monitor black patriotism or lack thereof during World War One, primarily. And during that time, you know, he was the one who was responsible largely for making sure that folks don't get too riled up or get out of line. So in a stroke of genius, what he was developing was, you know, if I can't beat them, you know, join them and then beat them. It was an institution. Not until the 70s did the NAACP really have even a black president. This was something that was ran by Europeans for a long time. And that's one reason that many within the Niagara movement never joined the NAACP, like Monroe Trotter and, you know, others who flocked to the National Equal Rights League. They didn't want to be part of an integrated civil rights movement. They wanted, they knew if, you know, the Europeans were running it, founding it, you know, if, et cetera, that they want to hit the leadership position. And they didn't know how to relate to our struggle like that, even though, you know, certainly European people of European descent could mean well and could support with their own institutions outside of ours. Many people didn't want to get in an organization and wind up, you know, submitting to them, having to pay them, the, you know, charters and all this sort of stuff. It kind of gave the message that we couldn't do anything for ourselves. So, you know, we decided not to. But anyway, because the UNIA never took anyone but people of African descent in the membership ranks, many people thought it was going to fail. You know, when Garvey started to develop industry successfully and started conducting business and trade, many people predicted it would.
Can I interrupt here a moment? You said at the opening of the show that there were a lot of myths and misconceptions about Mr. Garvey. What about the rumor that he was involved with the KKK, and that might have been Senator Theodore Bilbo of Mississippi? What was that all about?
No, Senator Bilbo was much later. Yeah, the KKK incident was when Mr. Garvey was in Atlanta on a speaking tour visiting some of the divisions. One of the members of the KKK had found out, I think, that he was in the same hotel. They were, you know, in town, and they wanted to know what the aims and objects of the UNIA was. So they basically wanted to interview Mr. Garvey about the objectives of the movement. And since, you know, the KKK at that time was considered the invisible empire, you know, this was one that, you know, white citizens' councils and all these institutions were influencing politicians and political figures. You know, most of the U.S. government was ran by a bunch of, you know, racist, segregationist, southern, you know, people. The KKK was, you know, a white nationalist movement, and the UNIA was a black nationalist movement. So, you know, there was a belief that we wanted or believed in black and white integration, and we were trying to, you know, set black men up to marry white women. And Mr. Garvey basically accepted the interview and, you know, assured them this wasn't our interest. We were for a degree of separation, et cetera. We're not here to take this or do this. We're trying to develop, just like, you know, the Zionists or the Jews set up their motherland in Israel, we're trying to set up a strong, powerful nation in Africa that can live, support the people of African descent, you know, and those who want to go can go, those who don't, you know, can, et cetera. But he kind of stated some of the aims and objects. And after that meeting, some of his opponents or enemies started to make the ridiculous argument that Garvey had joined the KKK, as if he could even join the KKK if he wanted to, which is ridiculous. Right. And he wound up writing extensively about why he accepted that. In the same way that you'll see today, you know, President Obama will meet with certain other countries that we are having problems with. You know, generals meet generals in the battlefield. If you have a group that's, you know, threatening my group, and, you know, my group feels, you know, you feel threatened by us, then we need to have, you know, the heads come meet and say, these are going to be the rules of engagement. This is going to be the how we lay down the law. You know, we're going to do things this way, and we're not going to do it. You don't cross this line, I don't cross that line. But that kind of meeting was pretty much, you know, the most that came out of it. But there was an exploitation of that meeting that he had supported the KKK and all this kind of crazy stuff, and people just, you know, exploited the situation, which really was not that big a deal, but it was significant in the extent that he got directly from the KKK an idea of what their interests were and what they were doing. And, you know, they developed the understanding amongst, you know, organization to organization. So that's kind of the myth, you know, but people kind of exaggerate that.
We're running out of time here and about to close. Could you tell us a little bit how the vessel of Phyllis Wheatley, the vessel that was called Phyllis Wheatley to his arrest?
Now the Phyllis Wheatley was controversial for no intelligent reason. At the time, the Phyllis Wheatley was the sixth ship of the Black Star shipping line. At the time, Mr. Garvey had five ships of the Black Star line that were on the open seas and doing well. He was traveling throughout Costa Rica and taking care of business. But what had happened, they had put the down payment on a sixth ship, which was called the SS Phyllis Wheatley. And on this sixth ship, they had already, you know, put a down payment to ownership. They had sent it to the shipping board to, you know, approve their insurance arrangement, et cetera. And the insurance board, you know, the shipping board basically deliberately held it up, you know, for a long period of time. So during this time, supposedly, and this is no proof whatsoever, but supposedly during this time, one of the secretaries in the office of the Black Star Line had sent out to some of the shareholders asking them to buy more shares. They sent out a flyer saying that the Black Star Line had, you know, six ships on the open seas. And one of the informants of the FBI, who supposedly was the recipient of that letter, he contacted the FBI and told him, hey, y'all, you know, I got a letter of Garvey saying he got six ships. I only thought he had five. So they told him, good, bring it on down. That's evidence. That's what we need. So he ran it on down to the FBI and gave them the envelope. And when they opened up the envelope, it was nothing in it. It was an empty envelope. And they, you know, asked him, where'd it go? I don't know. It must have fell out. But they said, don't worry about it. Just your testimony enough would be good enough. So based on a testimony, an empty envelope, and a testimony of an informant who was working for the FBI, that Garvey had prematurely sent out a flyer promoting six ships before the shipping board finalized it. Based on that most ridiculous charge of conspiracy to commit mail fraud, Mr. Garvey, he had three other people who were charged at the same time. They all were exonerated, you know, acquitted of the charge. Mr. Garvey Hone was convicted of conspiracy. He physically had nothing to do with the letter. He was even out of the country at the time. He was charged with a conspiracy to commit mail fraud, given 5 years in prison, made to pay all the court costs for the prosecution, his own, you know, everything. I mean, and immediately deported the minute they could get him out of the country. This was the punishment he got for organizing, you know, this economic justice movement for people of, you know, his race. You know, a lot of even European or, you know, politicians of European descent in America and abroad were outraged at this, you know, case. You know, they were laughing and joking. This is the worst travesty of justice we've seen in a long time. You know, no one believes that something so ridiculous could actually happen. But this is the story. They wanted to have the conviction so they can get him out of here. And hopefully by discrediting him, they could decentralize the movement and, you know, bust it up and abate any resistance to any of their further schemes or, you know, control and regulate people of African descent in America. But it's a serious travesty of justice, and very few actually look into the matters of the case. In fact, the Congress had at one point in 1987 called for an exoneration hearing, and the subcommittee, I think, on criminal justice reviewed the case and found that Mr. Garvey was completely innocent of all these charges. When they sent it to the president to sign, and, you know, at that time he didn't, under Reagan. But that's another story.
Mm-hmm. What do you want young freedom fighters today to learn from Garvey's story? Are there anything out there, books, that you can direct them to?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, what time is it? Always right behind. Well, yeah, I would say again, you know, visit our site. The UNIA is still active today. We still got divisions all across the globe. We're still recruiting new members. I'm the international organizer, so my job is to kill the worst enemy of our race, which is disorganization. And anyone who wants to join ranks, ask any questions, they can contact me on my Facebook, Maury Amar Kamal. I guess you can spell it for me, I can spell it. Or you can email me at MauryAmar1@AOL. I'll spell that for you. Maury Amar is spelled MWAR. IAMA, and for the email, that's again MWARIAMA1@AOL.com. Maury Amar Kamau, you know, KAMAU is my last name. I'm on Facebook, Millions for Marcus. You can go to the UNIA-ACL.org site. If I can even get my number out, people certainly can contact me even by phone.
Okay, what is that?
And that's 202-256-6380. I'll say it one more time, 202-256-6380.
Are there any movies or plays, anything like that out there in the community that people can go learn more?
Yeah, there's a number of books. I have probably 70, 80 books in my collection written about Garvey. There's about four or five documentaries. There's a couple that I would caution people to, you know, look at with a grain of salt because they do a lot of unnecessary elevation of rumors and innuendo to the level of fact to besmirch his name, which, you know, undo. But there's a lot of documentaries, there's a lot of films, you know, a lot of websites, a lot of information available. But the best way to really understand Garvey is to read his work.
What are the best of those documentaries that you would recommend?
The best one, I would probably say Black Nationalist, Marcus Garvey, Toward Black Nationalism. I would say maybe after that, Giant of Black Politics. That's kind of some of his individuals. One of the best and worst would be Look for Me in the Whirlwind, written by, you know, PBS, produced by PBS. Robert Hills is the moderator and does the commentary. And they have some, you know, good footage, and they got a lot of bad footage in there. But there's a lot of – it shows you the scope of the movement, at least.
Any museums?
There are – the Liberty Hall in Jamaica is actually a museum. The Schomburg certainly has a lot of information. The DuSable Museum actually has a collection. I'm trying to get them to bring out of storage because the centennial of the UNIA is coming in 2014. I'm actually working at this moment on a book to – highlight a pictorial history, you know, a coffee table book to highlight the pictorial history of the Garvey movement. And you can go to Marcus Garvey Culture Club on Facebook also to see a number of the pictures. I probably have about 40, 50 pictures up there. But there's hundreds that I have in the collection that's soon to be released on the publication. But, there's sources of information everywhere, you know. But if you want as much factual information from original sources, I definitely would encourage everyone to call, contact me, you know, read what you read. But before you accept it as fact, you know, give me a call or email or, you know, Facebook message or something along that line. And I'll make sure.
I want to thank you for joining us tonight. We're out of time. I really appreciate your enthusiasm. And
thank you.
And maybe we can get together again. Okay?
Yes, sir. I look forward to any time, you know.
All righty. Good night.
Good night. One God, one aim, one destiny.
Right on. Well, there you have it, folks. My name is Preston Washington. I've been your host here on The Gift of Freedom. Our guest was Mr. Malari Kumu, who was talking to us about the Marcus Garvey organization, the UNIA, Universal Negro Improvement Association. Brought a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of information to us tonight. And I hope you have a good night, and we'll catch up with you later. Good night, everybody.